Majors & Quinn presents David Troyer.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Majors & Quinn Booksellers. My name is Anne, and I'm the events coordinator here, and thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I'm very excited about our author tonight. The very talented David Troyer, is in the store for his new novel, Prudence, which is his first novel in 7 years. David is Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's been publishing fiction and nonfiction since he was 24 years old, and his essays and reviews have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Esquire, and the Washington Post, among others. He has a PhD in anthropology and teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. He also happens to be one of the best professors I've ever had and a good mentor and friend. So I'm especially excited about this event. I'm always excited about them, but I never thought I would be introducing a former professor here at Majors & Quinn. So tonight, David is going to read from his book, Prudence, and talk about it, as well as take questions. Afterwards, he will be available to sign books at that glass display case that was to your left as you came in. You can get a book signed and then purchase it on your way out. And by purchasing a book, you're not just supporting a great writer, but also an independent family-owned business, and we really appreciate your support. Now, please join me in welcoming David Troyer.
Thanks, Anne. Let me grab my book. This is, I think, what my funeral will feel like. Because those things, you're mixing all your genres, right? You know, you have former students show up, and you have family, you know, and you have colleagues and friends. And so that's about the only time it would happen, I imagine, either a reading back home or when I die. So thanks for coming for this one, and see you at the next one. Well, I won't see you, but you'll see me. So it is really, really great to be back in Minnesota, although I have to say that the weather isn't exactly what I ordered. But it is really nice to be back home in the place where you have to scrape off the inside and outside of your windshield. I mean, who else gets to do that? So, Anne, thanks for the... Where's Anne? She was also one of my best students, but the other ones of my best students are also here. So thank you for the introduction. That was really great. I appreciate it. I'm going to talk, mostly, because I mostly like talking. And I figure mostly you can read on your own. I'm betting on it. And I'm counting on it. I think I'll talk a little bit about the book and how it came to be. And then I'll read, of course, some, and then we can talk some more. And then there'll be lots of time for questions and answers, one hopes. So Prudence has three origin points, I guess. At least three that I can identify in sober backcast. And one of them was, well, when I was a graduate student, when I was at the University of Michigan, when I was just a kid, and I was broke, I would haunt the remainder table at Borders. And because you got a lot of words for your dollar at the remainder table, right? And so I bought this literary biography of Hemingway, about whom I couldn't really be bothered much for about Hemingway, or I couldn't really muster much enthusiasm for Hemingway. But I got 800 pages for $4, and that was pretty tight. And I read it, and in somewhere in there, the biographer's talking about Hemingway's early years vacationing in Michigan. And he quotes Hemingway as saying, "The first woman I ever pleasured was an Ojibwe half-breed girl named Prudence Bolton," end quote. Yeah, right? I mean, we know he didn't pleasure anybody. I mean, that's pretty certain. I don't even think he pleasured himself, you know? I think he failed at that as well. But That's something, right? And the biographer did some due diligence and did some research to see if that could possibly be true, and found out that there was indeed a girl named Prudence Bolton who lived near Traverse City, and that her path quite likely crossed that of Hemingway's when he was a teenager. All he was able to really find out about her was that she and her lover, Richard Castle, committed suicide together by drinking strychnine when she was pregnant. She was 19 years old, I think, at that time. And that's all we know about Prudence Bolton. Now, she does show up in the Hemingway stories, in the Nick Adams stories, as Trudy and Prudy and Prudence. She always shows up, not with any kind of agenda or desires or life of her own. She's really just there to educate Nick Adams about the meaning of life, you know, and introduce him to the ideas of sex and death. That's her job, right? And but it stuck with me, and it stuck in my head, and it's felt sort of profoundly and systematically unfair that we know much about people like Hemingway, and we know much about Hemingway, but we have volumes and, you know, thousands of pages about him and what he thought and what he felt and what he wanted. And we have one sentence about Prudence Bolton, and we often don't even get that much about people like Prudence Bolton. And so I always wondered over the many years, you know, what was her life like, and why did she do that? And was this a desperate act, or did she think of it differently? And what did her life mean to her, and what did she want? All the stuff that you can't know, but that's the job, right, of a novelist, is to try and figure out, to try and to ponder where the record leaves off. So anyway, she was in my head. And then... also in my head, this is something completely unrelated. When I was a kid, you know, we didn't take vacations. And so we took a vacation once. I guess my parents were really sick of us or themselves or each other or something. And so we went exactly 14 miles away from the house and stayed at a resort exactly 1 mile from the village that my mother's from. When you go, you don't go far. It's like, you know, if we're going to travel some distance to be miserable, might as well keep the distance short. And if my family's listening to this podcast, Mom, it was a great vacation, and it was really so much fun, and I love you so much. And so while we were there, you know, we were fishing for perch or something off the dock, as Minnesotans do. And my dad, who could just never be quiet about any historical fact, right, Eva, you know this, right? You can't just have a conversation, you have sort of a lesson. He said, well, you know, there's a German prisoner of war camp just over there. And this is when I was 13, and this is when, sort of in my nerdy, sort of very quiet life, World War II was the thing that I thought about the most, and I made plastic models and little dioramas and, you know, built tanks and planes and sort of studied the machine of war, right, World War II. I was enamored of it. I just thought that was the craziest thing I'd ever heard for a number of reasons. One, because it was my passion at the time, and two, because even then, I think, even at 13, I'd somehow come to think of reservations as many people, I think, come to think of them, which is places that are kind of outside of time, lands that time forgot. And all that really happens there is some sort of performance of eternal suffering, right? After 1890, when the frontier, quote-unquote, closed, we entered this state of suspended animation where we just suffer continuously. And nothing really happens. Nothing really changes. And the nation will check in on us to make sure that that's exactly what we're doing. That's our function, right, in the popular imagination. So the New York Times will go to Pine Ridge, right, and they'll report back, like, yep, you know, high rates of alcoholism, poverty, it's bad there. Next year they'll go back, yep, same thing, right? It's like they're just checking in to make sure that we're doing our job of suffering. It's always Pine Ridge, usually, well, it's almost always Pine Ridge. I'm from one, kind of felt the same way. So to me, that history had interceded, that it had landed and lived at Leech Lake in the form of a German prisoner of war camp was stunning to me. It jarred. It didn't fit with my idea of the place that I was from. And so I kept that in my head, too, unrelated to Prudence Bolton, of course. And then, I don't know, a few years ago, my father got a visit from an old colleague of his, someone with whom he used to work at Red Lake Reservation back in the 60s for a program called CAP, Community Action Program. And they were reminiscing about the good old days and sort of their hijinks and all the stuff that they did. And then they proceeded to together tell quite possibly the saddest story I had I had ever heard, which was that in the village of Panema in the 60s, everybody had dogs, everybody. Right? Nobody had a vet. No one could afford a vet. No one was going to drive to Bemidji to get their dog fixed. Right? So the dogs had a party. It was like daily, 24/7 partying for all the canines. And so there's lots of dogs. There's dogs everywhere, packs of dogs. They're just big, just mobs of dogs everywhere. They ran wild. They ran deer. And they got to be a problem. But once a year, the men in the village would gather. And they'd pick a day. And they'd all suit up. And they'd go out and they'd shoot dogs. And then bring the population back down. And if you loved your dog, you just kept your dog home that day. And if you didn't like the other 8 dogs hanging out at your house, well, you just shoot him away, and then they got shot. So these 2 guys were out shooting dogs, and as part of this bigger group, they peeled off and were cruising some roads around the village, and they saw some dogs in the brush, and so they shot one, and it started kicking in the leaves, it's death, death throes, and you don't want to approach a wounded animal, so they just waited till it stopped, and then they walked up to throw it in the truck, and they saw that it was not a dog at all. It was a girl who'd been skipping school with a friend of hers. And they'd just been playing hooky and smoking cigarettes or something like that, and these men had shot her and killed her. In a really tiny village, this is major, right? And I always wondered, when he told me that story, what a horrible freak accident, but I wondered what he felt like. What would it feel like to carry that, for the rest of your life? Something you could never, just when it's right, when it's done, it should never have happened, and there's nothing you can do to take it back. And so that sort of lived in my head. And all these sort of things, is, I don't know how writers' heads work. I just know how this one does, sort of. And but, you throw enough in the closet, they're going to fumble around for a while and sort of, catch each other and become related somehow. And so they did. And then that was what spawned Prudence, which is a World War II novel. It takes place when on a resort on a reservation, much like Leech Lake. And it begins when the son of the resort owners comes home from college for one last vacation before he joins the Air Corps and goes to fight in Europe. And before they can celebrate his return, a German prisoner has escaped from the prisoner of war camp across the river from the resort, and so they go out after him. novels are a matter of imagining, sort of taking any situation and imagining the worst possible outcome. And so the worst possible thing happens, and then that sets everything else in motion. I think I'll read just a little bit from the prologue, and then I'll talk a little bit more, then read some other parts from later on. This takes place in 1952. Everyone remembers that day in August 1952 when the Jew arrived on the reservation. In later years, the Indians would sometimes wonder idly at the strange fact of his arrival and his departure on the first train to Minneapolis the next morning. But the Jew was forgotten that day, until then a day like any other. Hot and muggy and filled mostly with the thrum of wind-plucked power lines and the crack of grasshoppers lifting out of the sand and spent grass. The Jew stepped off the train and into the thoughts of the villagers, and he exited the station and their minds just as quickly, because an hour or two after the train groaned to a stop, one of the hotel maids found Prudence's body in the room above the wigwam bar. And then there was that. Her poor young body arched and twisted and frozen in the August heat. And Prudence's baby, too, whom no one saw alive, not even Prudence, in its little cathedral of blood. And then there was that, too. Not long after the maid found her, the sheriff had come. After him, the coroner. Then Felix and Billy separately. Soon, everyone in the village, Indian and white and in between, had gathered outside the hotel and in front of the hardware store and the grocers, on the platform that served the depot, and in the wigwam itself. Since the village didn't consist of more than those small stores and the 100 or so Indians and loggers whose houses clustered around the railroad tracks, the gathering didn't look like much. It was, as dramatic events go, quiet. There wasn't much fuss when her body was loaded onto a canvas stretcher, covered with a white sheet, and handed down the narrow stairs like a ham in paper. No one raised a fuss, even though she was 26 and pregnant and alone, and now dead. Just wasn't that kind of village. And northern Minnesota wasn't that kind of place. Besides, it was 1952, and there was a war on. The world was much too big to worry itself about a dead Indian girl. No one wondered really what had happened or why, in the way people who aren't accustomed to being wondered about discover they dislike thinking about themselves. It was too hot in any event to do more than sit and shake one's head. No, it was much better not to think of Prudence at all. Obviously, that's a challenge, right, to you to, you know, to give a shit. And to us, right? You know, you try to, I try, you know, to reverse the polarities of some of this stuff. I was so curious, you know, about what her life, what someone's life might be like, what someone like her, what her life would feel like to her, what her values, her desires, what her wants would be. I don't know. I mean, it almost feels like a civic duty, not just a novelistic duty, to imagine the lives of others and to try on their cares and concerns a bit. And I think if we did a bit more of that, well, this would be a slightly different country, I think, than it is. I'm going to read a piece from a little bit later in the book, but earlier in time. So there's what evolves, a love triangle evolves in the center of this story between Prudence after she shows up and Frankie, the son of these resort owners, and the boy that Frankie's in love with and that sort of reciprocates those feelings, Billy, who's from the reservation and who used to work as a dock boy at the resort and became friends with Frankie, you know, very early on. And there are a lot of things, you know, that I was wondering what might sort of be forbidden at that time. What wants could never be met? You know, what desires, you know, couldn't be spoken? And, well, I don't know, Native and white people, we've been, you know, getting together for hundreds of years, you know, not such a big deal. Rich and white, well, you know, rich and poor, well, I don't know, there aren't really many rich people up there. There weren't then, anyway. But, you know, two young men who have strong sort of feelings for one another in the way that these two do, well, that would be something that you wouldn't talk about. And that these boys themselves, being so innocent and so in love, actually, don't even really have a good language for. They don't even have words for what they feel and what they want and what they want to do with and to the other. They just don't have it. They have the feelings, but they don't have the vocabulary, much less any kind of framework to understand what it is they want, except that they do know that they can't tell anybody what it is they want. So I'll read a little bit of Billy, who I really am very fond of. It's just horrible. You know, novels are horrible things to do to people. It's sort of like you're doing something to people. Not just, you know, the audience, but the characters, right? You make them. You know, you spend time with them. They're not real, but you're still fond of them anyway. And then you just do the most unspeakable things to them. It's not nice at all. So anyway, Billy's is waiting for Frankie to get off the train so they can have this reunion, which is long overdue. Billy waited on the raised cement platform outside the station in his new jacket and driving cap. The train was due at noon, and it was past due. It was hot, and the sun, pretty much straight overhead, didn't burn off the moisture so much as set the air to boil. It was sticky, and there wasn't much wind. The jacket was the wrong thing for the weather. Brown wool. Though anything else would have been ruined in weeks, if not days. and it had to last him through the winter. It was all they had at Neeson's anyway. The jacket had cost $5 and the cap had cost $2. $7 for that getup. Through the spring, until breakup, Billy had gone out to Dick Bolton's camp down 6 Mile and peeled spruce for 5 cents a stick. Dick got 10 cents from the boss, but he gave Billy and the other kids 5, even his own son, Dickie Jr., that's what he got. And so it had taken Billy 140 sticks to get that hat and that coat. 140 8-foot balsam and popple logs peeled with a sharpened leaf spring and lifted over end into a neat pile for the skidder. And then Bolton would charge them 10 cents for kerosene and a rag to get the pitch off before he and the other boys walked back to the village. Still, he'd saved his nickels, and by summer he had a good bankroll. He added to it by gutting and flaying fish at Lion's Landing, a nickel a fish. On weekends, he went to the Pines and helped Felix get the place ready. There weren't as many people coming up this summer because of the war, only Felix and Emma for all of June and July. Ernie's parents weren't coming up this year, but Ernie was supposed to arrive with Frankie. Billy did whatever Felix and Emma asked of him. He unwrapped blankets and bedding for the cabins, beat the braided oval rug that lay in front of the split stone fireplace with a canoe paddle, whitewashed the cabins, and knocked the swallows' nests off the eaves of the big house with a broom. Emma spent her days gliding from room to room, changing the knickknacks, rearranging the chairs, making lists. Sometimes she spent the afternoons laboring under a vow of exhaustion in her room. She tried to pay Billy, as she had in the old days when he started working as a dock boy in 1930, but he refused. Frankie was his friend. He was simply helping his friend's mother. The real payment, the real reward, would be Frankie himself and his reaction when he arrived and breathed in the smell of wool and wood smoke and paste wax and cedar of the Pines. So the money he saved, nickel by nickel, did not come from the Washburns, and that meant something to Billy. Everything seemed to pay a nickel in those days. A pint of blueberries, a peeled spruce log, a filleted walleye. The train was coming in. "Nice coat, Billy. Real nice." Billy looked up, and there he was. Frankie leaned out over the steps, his boater in his hand, his smile broad. Billy couldn't keep himself from smiling because that coat had cost him 100 peeled and piled logs, and he was thrilled that Frankie had noticed, but of course he had. That's just how he was. Billy didn't move from where he leaned against the beam of the depot's porch, in part because the coat was so hot and so uncomfortable he didn't want to soak his shirt. He willed himself to stay put, his hands in his pockets, the brim of his hat just so. Like an actor in one of the movies they showed in the town hall on Friday nights. The train was slowing down, nearly stopped, and Frankie said something to someone behind him and jumped off and turned to bow with his hat in his hand to whoever it was and ran over to Billy and stretched out his arm and shook Billy's hand. Frankie's hand felt small in his, but it had the same cool, moist feeling that excited him. It was only then that Billy unleaned himself from the post and stood tall. He'd grown a lot in the last year, and his work in the camps had broadened his shoulders and chest, and he noticed, happily, that he was just as tall as Frankie was, and heavier through the shoulders and arms. "How you been keeping?" asked Frankie. Frankie had on some kind of suit, linen, maybe. He looked right at Billy, still shaking his hand, still smiling and smiling, like he couldn't believe his luck. Frankie's hair was cut short on the sides and left long on top. He was as thin as ever, but his cheeks were tanned and his eyelashes dusty-looking in that way of theirs. The sun shone through his ears and made them glow red a little. He seemed happy. "You look great, kid. You look really great," said Frankie. "Look what else," said Billy, and he opened his jacket wide. He'd been rehearsing the move. Frankie's eyes went wide when he saw the corked pint bottles sticking out of the inside pockets of Billy's coat. "I like how you think, kid," said Frankie. "I really like how you think. I appreciate your vision." Billy was 1 year younger, but he was just as big as Frankie now. Bigger. Stronger, for sure. The kid thing must be from some movie. Frankie wrote him about the movies he saw at the Princeton Garden Theater and the lawn parties they had at Ivy. His trips to New York. Worlds Billy couldn't quite imagine without Frankie's help. Frankie sent books, too. These he read and reread and kept in a wooden crate under his bed. Billy wasn't sure he understood the books, but he tried, if only to understand Frankie, who lived among the kinds of people in those books, visited houses like theirs, walked the streets of the cities they described. As for movies, the only ones Billy saw were years old, just whatever the movie man brought in the circular tins on the back of his Model A and projected against the back wall of the town hall. The village didn't have a movie theater. It didn't have a library either, other than the one long shelf in the schoolhouse. Billy had read all those books by the sixth grade. 20 miles away, the high school library was bigger, but not by much. He read all those, too. "Hey," said Frankie, over his shoulder, "look who's here." Oh, I should say, by the way, that, you know, there are many reasons to write. There's many reasons not to, of course. More reasons not to. But one of the reasons to write is revenge. So you might recognize who's coming. Just then, Ernie came tumbling out of the train. He had on a linen suit too, but his was crumpled, and his hair was sweaty and plastered to his head. He must have lost his hat somewhere between Chicago and St. Paul. You know, I remember something else just now. Like, one of the things, like, when I was thinking about Hemingway and the prudence he bragged about pleasuring, I remember thinking to myself, like, we know he's a liar, right? And so I kind of thought to myself, like, what if that never happened? What if that never happened? What if he wanted it to happen, or he thought it made a good story, but it didn't happen, right? What if other people were getting their satisfaction, but it wasn't Hemingway? He knew about it, and he spun a lie, right? And so I thought, who else would be doing it, you know? And so that's in part sort of where the relationship between Frankie and Billy sort of came to me. It just occurs to me. It's an epiphany, Charlie. I mean, a realish one. He'd grown a small black mustache back to Ernie. His hands were hairy, but it was the same wide, square face, the same barrel body, the same keen, cruel, sharp, sly body. Another boy filed out behind Ernie. He was slender, quiet, Davy Gardner. His parents owned the mill, and he was just done with college, too. He nodded politely. "Hey, Billy." "Dave," said Billy. Ernie looked at Billy, but not with the same warmth as Frankie. Ernie rubbed his eyes and stretched as if he'd just gotten out of bed, and the train and the depot and the prospect of the pines all constituted some chore, some duty that he must submit to. He walked over to where Billy and Frankie stood gaping at each other, their handshakes still thrumming up and down, slowing noticeably, but still a warm, full grip. He stood with his fists on his hips and then turned them around to push against his lower back. He seemed distracted and drunk, but Billy knew that Ernie saw everything in that shrewd way small, mean people see everything. He studied Billy as though looking at something for sale. "Look what Billy's got," said Frankie. Billy opened his coat again, the same way as before, but it felt awkward, as though he were on display, like he was acting without an audience. The coat felt shabby now, like something he paid $5 for. Ernie leaned toward Billy, his head low, and squinted. And he reached out right there in front of the station agent and the loggers and the vacationers and picked out one of the bottles and held it up to the sun. "It's got no bond," he said. "No mark either." "Well, it'll work, won't it?" asked Frankie. "It's not for us anyways," lied Billy. "You know, it's for girls." He'd gotten those pints from Bolton, who'd charged him $1 each. 40 sticks of balsam. 40 sticks peeled and piled for those two stupid bottles. "Indian girls, maybe," said Frankie. "Or other kinds, I suppose," he said, looking at Billy with that look of his. "Come on, let's see what we can do." Ernie led the way, and the four of them left the station agent to manage the luggage while they crossed the street to the wigwam. Ernie opened the door, and Frankie and David followed him. I'll wait out here, said Billy. You know, on lookout. Sure, said Ernie. Sure. Billy felt the day going terribly wrong. It had gotten off its track somehow. Already things seemed beyond fixing. And this was the last time that Frankie would be there, and who knew how long. 5 minutes later, Ernie and Frankie and David came out. Ernie held a paper bag in which 2/5 clanked together. What'd you get? Asked Billy. 8 roses, said Ernie, smiling to himself. Here, he said, and he handed the bag to Billy and lit a cigarette. He didn't move to take the bag back after it was lit. Got the scoop from Harris, said Ernie through his cigarette smoke. Seems some German has escaped from that camp. Guess he plans on heading down the Mississippi. He skipped yesterday, said Billy, grateful that he had more of the story than Ernie did. Frankie was excited. Maybe I'll get a German before I even leave the States, he said. I can paint a swastika on my plane before I even leave the ground. Those are for planes you shoot down, not for returning escaped prisoners, said Ernie. Still, said Frankie, still, we can do our part, right? They're organizing search parties. How about it, Billy? Sure, said Billy. Swell. But it wasn't swell. He'd been hoping for the usual ritual of the pines, the big meal on the front porch, and water skiing behind the Chris Craft, and a chance to go fishing with Frankie. With any luck, Ernie would pass out, like he usually did. They walked to the pickup and took drinks from one of the bottles while the station agent loaded the luggage. When he was done, they all got in the cab shoulder to shoulder, Ernie behind the wheel, David next to him, next Frankie, and then Billy by the window. Frankie put his arms in the backrest, as though they were all members of the same club. We're going to have ourselves a time, boys. We're definitely going to have a time, said Frankie. Ernie lit another cigarette and talked about fishing. Frankie talked about the Air Corps and B-17s. He switched from topic to topic without completing his thoughts. His hat was pushed back on his head, and his words were a little slurred, with liquor or excitement or both. Frankie's arm was heavy and light across Billy's shoulders. Billy's heart felt heavy and light, too. Frankie's hand cupped Billy's shoulder and stayed there, and Billy looked out over the fields and clear cuts and scrub as Ernie drove them to the landing so they could cross the river to the pines. The day was already half over. So I'll leave that there. And I don't know, what time is it? We could talk now. That would be fun. Thank you very much. You can clap, it's okay. It's fine if you do that. That's totally fine. If there's questions, I'm happy to chat. Yeah.
Here's somebody asked if there was gonna be a sequel.
There's never a sequel in my life. It's true, you know. I mean, when I'm done, I'm done, you know. I mean, different writers are different. Some writers evolve a kind of cottage industry where all the books are part of some big family, or they evolve a kind of brand, you know? And that's a thing, but it's not my thing. And the writers that I like are the ones who try for the unexpected every time, you know? Peter Carey's one of those writers for me. Ishiguro is one of those writers for me, too. And that's what I admire. And so for me, the only reason I get up out of bed and or get off the couch and get to my desk, you know, is to try something I'm not sure I can do. And then once I've done it, I don't ever want to do it again. And I want to try something else. And it's totally self-defeating, right? Because it's like with every book, I'm an amateur. But I just don't know how else to do it. I don't. So no, there won't be any sequel, I'm sorry to say, you know, but if they make a movie, we could lobby for it, and they can follow up, right? They can do whatever they want, I don't care, so.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand this book to be a little more
extended. Okay, so you're wondering if my perspective on Native American literature, broadly construed, has changed from 2006 when the User's Manual came out, between then and now?
To some extent.
So the question is, I have to repeat it for the podcast, but I also have to repeat it for myself,
yeah,
right? So the question is, you know, is there a balance that I strike between any kind of artistic or aesthetic mission and some greater educational or social mission of writing what's considered Native American literature. And how do I strike that balance, and has it changed? Is that close? That's pretty close. We'll just say it is. We'll say that's what you said, right? Well, I suppose it's always changing, so that's the simple answer. You know, but never to leave a well-intentioned question alone, that's just not my style. Like, I sort of question the idea of a mission at all, right? I mean, I have a pretty local one with each book. I mean, with the Pellies, which may be what you're thinking about, my last novel, I was really curious to see if I could take a guy who had sort of in no way conformed to any ideas that we have about Native folk. I mean, he was a loner, he lived in a city, he was highly educated, he was sort of antisocial, he's a librarian, all he cares about is books. You know, tropically, he didn't register. He didn't even count when we think of an Indian character. And could we make him so? Could we change our understanding by the method of that novel, so that he actually emerges and in a way that we don't expect, and we see him in an entirely different fashion by the end, right? That was the goal of that one. That was my mission. Like, can I do this? It seems sort of esoteric, but that's what got me going, among other things, right? I was also interested in that book and looking at how sort of the only reason why literature either A, makes sense, or B, is pleasurable, is because it's every book's nearest relatives are other books, not the culture of the author, right? And I still believe that, you know. A book's relatives are other books seems so sensible to me, you know. Yes, the identity of the author matters to a degree, right? The author isn't quite dead. But, so I wanted to explore those relationships in that book. And in Prudence, I've got a whole different mission, you know. I mean, the goal, sort of the aesthetic, artistic goal was, can I write a plot-driven, character-driven novel that I've never done that? I mean, can I do it? It's not easy. It's pretty hard, actually, I found. Could I just use language to do, was the language only there for necessity? Could I write a book like that as opposed to sort of, you know, I'm good with words. I can get fancy. You know, I can fancy all day long. It's just a skill I have, you know, and it's also a skill that makes up for deficiencies that I have, and that's how it's functioned too. I just get all fancy when I write myself into a corner. And could I not do that? Could I withhold that crutch, and the language is only there to serve the character and story, and no more? I don't know. I think I did okay. So I don't think it wasn't a question of accessible. I mean, that wasn't what I thought about. I need to write an accessible novel. That wasn't my agenda. I think it probably is. But that wasn't the plan. And I wanted, as I discussed before too, I wanted to see, you know, see if I could adequately imagine someone's life that's like Prudence, who's so different than me and lives in a time different than my own. And sort of see her, imagine her fully. Which I think does some social good. That was the mission. This is different. That was a really good, complicated question.
A question was asked about David's interest in preserving the Ojibwe language.
Well, I dropped out of graduate school when I was a kid and moved back to Leech Lake, and then started working in language preservation and revitalization programs, and writing curriculum and sort of helping to start a school at White Earth. And I did that for a while. And then I sort of realized that working for nonprofits is actually worse than graduate school. Anyone who's worked for a nonprofit knows exactly what I'm talking about. Wherever your heart might be, you know, like, man, can't they just get it together? So I went back to graduate school and finished up. But then, you know, for a long time, and for a big part of my work has been or was still working with language. And that was a part of my academic work for a long time. But I moved to California 4 years ago, and so that work has fallen, to be perfectly honest, has fallen by the wayside. It's just hard to do that there. So I was working on a practical grammar of Ojibwe language with my brother and some other people, and now I'm not involved in that at all. Anton is, John Nichols from the University of Minnesota is, Michael Sullivan, who got his PhD at the University of Minnesota in linguistics, he's doing that. He teaches at in Duluth. And at St. Scholastica. So all these people who are just incredible. Incredible people and doing incredible work. They're on it, you know, among others. And I'm not. I'm basically a really vigorous cheerleader at this point for the effort. I think I'd have to move back home if that were going to become once again central to what I do. Plus, you know, I don't know. I've got kids, you know, so like, it's only so much I can do. I'm human after all, as it turns out, you know, but yeah. The question was, what about the process and what about the product gives me pleasure as a writer? Part of it is giving it to you. You know, books without readers are very lonely things. And, you know, and writers without readers are even lonelier because they complain. And books suffer silently, but writers not so much, you know. And so, I mean, anyone who says they don't write to be read but who publishes books is flat out lying, first and foremost. And there's a conversation you have. You're having a conversation with readers. You're sort of, you're moving into their head, but they're already in yours as a writer, right? You don't think of, I'm going to please this constituency, but you're thinking about, at least I am, readers, right? So giving pleasure is you know, brings it as well. There's that. But there are other kinds too. They're very small ones. I mean, large ones, having completed a thing, having surmounted some obstacle, having posed a challenge to oneself when you think about the book and then succeeded, you know, when the book is done. That's one. But there are small ones too. And these are just, you know, please just the self. I mean, no one's even going to notice, you know. Like, there's a chapter my favorite chapter in this book takes place in a bar on Christmas Eve in 1944. Prudence shows up to find out information about Frankie, who's overseas. And she's got no standing. She's got no right to expect that anyone will tell her anything. She doesn't really have a right to ask. So it's a complicated, festive moment. All right, the war's in the background. All these people are gathered in this little bar in northern Minnesota drinking Tom and Jerry's, which is what we do on Christmas Eve. And there's a pike hanging above the bar, you know, a stuffed pike, and someone stuck a Schlitz bottle in its mouth, you know, and it's just there. And they keep dancing around underneath it. And it's just a decoration. It's just a dead fish, you know. Prudence leaves without really learning anything, drunk, horribly drunk and despondent, and walks back to the pines where she lives, like 6 miles. It's very cold. It's cold like tonight. The next chapter takes place from the perspective of Felix, who's nominally her father, and he's having to deal with her, and she's a hot mess. She's a mess, right? And she wants something from him, and he gives her that, but not in the way that she expected. And it's bad. It doesn't work out well. And he knows it. He knows that something's ruptured between them. And as he's trying to go to sleep, and they're in this tiny little shack, right? It's really cold outside. He starts imagining, like, you know, maybe tomorrow we can decoy for Pike. Maybe we can do that. It'll be just like when she was younger and happy. You know, and he starts imagining cutting a hole in the ice, and they're going to decoy, and they're going to spear Pike, and it'll be something they can do together and remind them of the good days, which he knows in his heart are done. They're done. And so that pike that he imagines, and the pike in the bar, they have you're building little echoes and harmonies. No one's gonna notice this, right? I mean, no one's gonna notice it, except for me. That's a pleasure, you know. So there's all different kinds, you know.
Somebody asked what would bring David back to Minnesota.
Things bring me back all the time. But what would bring me back permanently? The only clear answer is time. I'll come back. I know I'm coming back. It's going to happen. And there's no doubt in my mind. There's never been a doubt in my mind of that. It's a question of when. You know, leaving Minnesota was, quite honestly, you know, both a best thing and a worst thing. I mean, this place is really the only place I care about, you know, quite like my mother's father, you know, my family in that regard. That said, I like California. I like where I live. I like the little town in which we live. I like being in the mix. It's a very sort of, there's a lot of currents and I like out there, and I like swimming in all of them, you know. It's feeding a part of me that wasn't being fed living in the Twin Cities for the decade I lived here. It's an adventure. And, you know, people say, well, you live in two worlds, but that's not true. You know, I don't like that. I just tried to make the one I live in just a little bit bigger. But I'll be back here for sure. There's no doubt about it. Second question. The question is, what's the interplay between my intellect, or maybe my sort of intellectual side, academic side perhaps even, and in my creative novel writing side, right? What's the interplay? What's the connection? That's the question, for those of you listening to the podcast. Well, it's there and it's profound. I mean, I guess I've accepted that I'm that kind of writer, you know, that I'm not simply a yarn spinner, although hopefully I'm that. But part of the pleasure, the sort of the bliss of writing fiction is the kind of critical work that the imagination can do, right? I mean, my studies were very parallel. I mean, I was learning how to write my first novel while I was getting my PhD in anthropology. On the surface, they don't have anything to say to one another, and my books are adamantly and resolutely anti-ethnographic, right? You don't get a lot of the three Fs in, you know, food, folklore, and fashion in my books, on purpose. I withhold that on purpose, so it frees me up to do other work. I mean, you know, novels are tricky things because the only reason why they work is because they are built on received knowledge, received creative aesthetic understandings, right? The only reason why they function is because of everything that's come before. So they're very conventional in that way. They're very conservative, actually, things, novels are, on one hand. On the other, the good ones, we think, you know, good literature actually pushes back against the received notion, the common understanding, common sense, the status quo, right? So they're both conventional and they're both conservative and sort of renegade at the same time. They're both, which is so schizophrenic, but that's, to me, how novels function. And that's the kind of book I try to write. Those are the kinds of books I like. That's a really good question. Did I answer it? Okay. Whew. Good. A couple more, and then you guys can go back out in the cold. The question is, okay. To what extent? Can you? Okay. Could you try for me? Okay. So is it problematic that I both rely on sort of an ongoing sort of genre or field of Native American literature? Right. Right. So am I a hypocrite? Yeah. No. I'm happy to phrase it that way. You know, as most hypocrites might do in such a situation, I'll be mealy-mouthed and say yes and no. The literary antecedents of Prudence, so, you know, at least the self-conscious ones, I mean, and leave it to critics to see what I might be drawing on and not know it, are things like Atonement, right? Thank you. That's a self-conscious sort of ancestor, right? I mean, to the point of, you know, I was thinking when I was reading Atonement, I'm like, you know, the English are so lucky. You know, they have all these manors, you know? Not manors with two N's, but these big houses that they live in. And, you know, where they have really rich people, and then they have people working for them, they have all this drama built into these places. But in America, we don't have, and they have a whole genre, the manor novel, right? Austin, among other, you know, and even Ishiguro has availed himself of that, and Downton Abbey is, of course, sort of a TV version of the manor novel. You know, Gosford Park, is that the name of the movie? Gosford, no R, right. And we don't have that. What do we have? What do we have that's like that? And I thought, resorts. like the pines. You know, so that's a self-conscious, for me, antecedent of this book. Not Silco and not Erdrick and you know, not Welch, not those guys. Not them. Just because. You know, and then there's, I mean, to the point where, and I notice it, and, you know, I'm okay with it. You know, the part I read where they're handing Prudence's body down the stairs, right? Like a ham and paper. Well, that's, have you read Child of God by Cormac McCarthy? Well, after they find Lester Ballard's stash of corpses in the cave, they wrap them all up and they hoist them out with ropes, like trussed up hams, right? Is I think the phrase at the very end of that novel. And I'm making a relationship, however dim, between this and Child of God, because I love that book, but this doesn't really have anything to do with it. Those are my conscious ancestors, right? The ones I'm choosing. Those ancestors you don't choose. And time will tell who they are. So is it hypocritical? I suppose it would be. I've always made the case that Native literature is best understood as American literature, and best understood as literature that is related to a world literature in English. And I just try to live that out, you know. Good, long questions. I think that's it, unless there's someone who's dying to ask something. If not, we can just chat on the side. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you. Oh, I should say, I'll tell you this, because I realize I have to say this, that I'd be really excited to talk and sign and visit afterwards, but there's something that happens to me. I don't know if this happens to anyone else, Ben or Greel or Charlie, anyone else, but after a reading, I get quasi-aphasic, and I can't remember anyone's names, right? This has happened to family. Like, I had an aunt come up to get a book signed, and I signed it Bonnie, and then she comes back, and she says, you know, you must have been thinking of my sister, because she has a sister, Bonnie. This is an aunt by marriage. And I said, oh, Tammy. My aunt. I've known her since I can even remember. So don't be upset. That's just my brain switching from a writing brain back to a human brain. And so, yeah, that happens. Don't be alarmed. So anyway, thank you.